We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No Maria this week. She is buried in work.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, you've seen those photos of people, like, buried in sand up to their neck at the beach. That's pretty much her this week. So.
Yeah. I don't actually understand the motivation with people that allow themselves to be buried in sand at the beach, but
I don't really either, except, you know, it makes for a compelling TikTok video, I guess.
Yeah.
That's about it. The problem is when, you know, your friends all walk away and leave you for the night.
Exactly. As the tide's coming in.
Yeah, exactly. It really requires a lot of misplaced trust.
Yeah. Well, it's a mistake you only make once.
Exactly.
So, we are how many weeks? Just a couple weeks away. I know
the ballots get mailed out the middle of next week.
Okay.
By this time next week, people should have their ballots. And if Maria is back, and we hope she will be, we'll start going through the ballot.
But in the meantime,
yes,
the candidates are attending forums. They're we saw a really wild flyer that went out this week.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So there are three seats up for re-election on King County Council. They are all the legacy Republicans who've been there for 20 or more years. The freshest of those, or the newest of those, is Kathy Lambert, who has only been on county council for 20 years. She represents what is geographically the largest district in King County, northeast suburbs and on out to the mountains. That has historically been a Republican district, as with the other Republican legacy office holders. The demographics have really changed in recent years. It's now really arguably a blue district, certainly purple. And so she was already facing a tough re-election fight against a woman named Sarah Perry, who has had a cogent and well-funded campaign. It's really the first time that Lambert has faced a serious re-election challenge in, you know, probably close to 20 years. She probably had internal polling that showed she was losing. That would be my guess anyway. And so she sent out this flyer this past week, which surfaced on Tuesday, that was meant, I think, to appeal to her base, but was really a lot of people really found offensive, specifically racist. It was a flyer comparing her opponent, Sarah Perry, calling her a marionette socialist, whatever that is. I think it means she's supposed to be a puppet. Specifically, she's a puppet of Kamala Harris, Shama Sawant, and the one person of color on the county council, a man whose name I still can't pronounce.
I don't have it right in front of me. But I think it's like Guillaume Zehle, but.
But anyway. The point is, he's the only person of color on the county council. And so she accused Perry of being a puppet, basically, of those three people, along with Bernie Sanders, who's a socialist puppet. The problem, of course, is that three of those four people are people of color, and none of them really, except arguably for Zara May, whose name I just butchered, have anything to do with what Perry would be doing on county council. Certainly Shama Sawant doesn't. Kamala Harris certainly doesn't. And Bernie Sanders definitely doesn't. And he's Jewish, to add insult to injury. And so a lot of people found that racist. A majority of the King County Council condemned the flyer. She has lost a lot of donors and a lot of endorsements over this. And remarkably, the Seattle Times endorsed her opponent, Sarah Perry, which, you know, given a choice in a competitive race, they almost always go with a Republican. That's how the Seattle Times rules. But according to the Seattle Times, Lambert has simply lost their trust. And it's true that this is not the first time she's shown really poor judgment. She had an incident with a DUI a few years ago, also in the middle of a reelection campaign, where she was verbally abusive towards the officer who pulled her over and tried to contest the ticket to no avail. But somehow, because she didn't really have serious opposition that year, she was reelected anyway. And she has had a number of these kind of incidents over the years, but has always managed to escape because she didn't have any serious opposition. This year she does. And she is probably toast at this point. She almost certainly, that was a really bad move on her part. You know, really a lot of the local politicos in Seattle are distancing themselves from her as far as they can. Which, you know, given that she's really kind of a toxic presence on county council, arguably the most conservative of the three Republican members, although Regan Dunn would probably, you know, arm wrestle her for that. You know, it's looking likely that she will lose in re-election. She was already in a bad position. In the primary, she got about 40% of the vote, which is never good for an incumbent if you're under 50%. Perry got 36%, but the person who finished third, who was also a Democrat, got another 24%. So combined, they had about 60% of the vote, which is a steep hill to climb if you're Lambert. And like I said, they probably had internal polling showing, number one, that she was losing, and number two, that this was a message that would resonate with her base. Well, it might resonate with her base, but the Republican base is no longer a majority in her district. And it really brings up the notion that after 20 years in office without serious opposition, she's pretty out of touch with her district, which has become much more diverse, much more Democratic leaning, over the past decade at least. So RIP Kathy Lambert, we won't have you to kick around anymore, probably after early November. And we'll see how that turns out.
And in addition to it being obviously racist, the images on that flyer are classic anti-Semitic images. If you include like Bernie Sanders being prominent on it and using the puppet image and idea, I mean, that's been used on numerous extreme right-wing
That goes posters. Back to Protocols of Zion. It really does.
Yeah,
it's bad news. And the images of the non-white people that she named were darkened artificially, which tells you again what the intent is in terms of who she's trying to reach. But and it's not pretty.
And as of Friday morning, she had posted on Facebook. She had doubled down again a second time on saying she basically was. It was unfortunate that people saw a problem with that, but, you know, she continued to support the message that she sent out. And apparently sometime between early morning and midday, she changed her mind and did an apology on Facebook. And you have to wonder, according to KNKX reporting, it looked like there was a sea of support that changed for the Washington Association of Realtors pulled back their endorsement. Seattle Mariners pulled back. Larry Gossett, who I guess had previously endorsed her, he rescinded
his surprise
endorsement.
Yeah, I mean, he served with her for a number of years, of course, but still. A lot of support and sympathy has gone to Zahale, who's the other county council member. She did apologize sometime around midday on Friday, yesterday. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those classic "I'm sorry if I offended anybody" type apologies, which doesn't really cut it. It certainly doesn't show any awareness of what you did that people are taking offense to. And that, again, is just breathtakingly out of touch, certainly with the 21st century, with much of the 20th century as well, honestly. So, I think she's done. I really do.
Well, we shall see soon enough if you're right.
Yep. Like I said, ballots arrive next week, and we will be going over the different choices. on the ballot for this year for the general election. And so stay tuned for that.
Yeah. All right. But other other developments this week, candidates are having dump trucks, at least some of them, dump trucks with money beeping as they back
some,
up.
Some of them are getting no money at all, which is they're not competitive anyway. But,
yeah.
I wanted to talk about the three city races that are most competitive. The first, of course, is mayor, where Bruce Harrell has made a huge late fundraising push. He's now up to $906,000 he has raised. That's not including the PAC money that he's support that he's receiving for. He had a huge fundraiser last night with Gary Locke and a number of other current and former elected officials, almost all of whom were not masked at an indoor event. So that tells you where Harrell is coming from, unfortunately. But he leads Gonzalez, who has $576,000, which is certainly enough to be competitive, and I suspect she's leading in the internal polling that the two campaigns are doing. But, we will see. Harrell, of course, has gotten the Seattle Times endorsement, a number of other pro-business endorsements. Gonzalez is the more progressive candidate. And it's gotten a lot of the labor endorsements, et cetera, and money from organized labor as well.
I had a flyer arrive yesterday. He got the endorsement of Seattle Fire Department.
That's not surprising. The fire department, as well as the police field, SPOG, tend to endorse in tandem, and they tend to go for the more conservative candidate. So I wasn't particularly surprised by that. What's interesting is that neither his money nor his endorsements are coming from his former district in South Seattle. They tend to be focused on downtown Seattle and on the wealthier neighborhoods in the city, which again tells you where he's coming from. The problem, of course, is that for anybody, and it's a small minority, I think, of voters who has witnessed any of the different forums that have been taking place for the last several months, really, but up to and including this week, Gonzalez lays out detailed, cogent plans about what she would want to do as mayor, and Harrell is breathtakingly incompetent and seems really unaware of a lot of the issues that are most important to Seattle. And we'll go over some of those next week, but it's you wonder, you would be astonished to find out if you didn't know that Harrell was on city council for 10 years, because he really does not seem aware of most of the issues facing the city. And he certainly isn't putting a plan out as to what he would do to address them. Now, in reality, probably his appointments and his policy positions are all going to come directly from the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce. And so he doesn't really have to think about it. But you wonder if he is, like, you know, mentally competent to serve as mayor, honestly. I mean, it's that incoherent. And why this hasn't been pointed out more often by people following the campaign, I don't know. But it's really obvious. It's not like I'm making a giant leap in making that observation. And Maria has said the same thing consistently over the past several months. So... we'll see whether that matters in a modern campaign, or whether you can win just by, you know, dumping boatloads of mailers in people's mailboxes. I know I've gotten 7 or 8 of them. I don't know about you, but
I'm disappointed, at least in this current round, of the number of mailers I've gotten. It's very few so far, whereas back in August it was plentiful.
Well, I expect that will change in the next couple of weeks. But yeah. But certainly among the different candidates, Harrell has had by far and away the most. And I wouldn't figure on most of the mailing lists that he would use the potential supporters.
I got at least 5 back in August, just for
mm-hmm. me. Yeah. I did as well, and they were almost all right at the end of the campaign. So that's why I'm figuring that I have plenty of TV ads and plenty of mailers in the next couple of weeks. So moving on to city attorney's race, That's much more competitive in terms of fundraising. Nicole Thomas Kennedy leads that with $276,000, which is a ton of money for really any down ballot race, but especially something as obscure as city attorney. It speaks to both of these candidates. Number one, there being a stark contrast between them, and number two, having a base that's very enthusiastic about them. The other candidate, Ann Davison, who's the conservative candidate in the race, and she's run as a Republican in the past. She's kind of a permanent candidate. This is her third campaign in 3 years. She has raised $239,000, which is quite a bit for somebody who's spectacularly unqualified for the job she's trying to get. That's just my, you know, 2 cents. And then the there's two at-large city council races that are up for re-election. In one of them, Teresa Mosqueda, who is the incumbent, doesn't really face any serious opposition. She's going to win easily. The other one is much more competitive, and again, a very stark contrast in ideologies between the two. On the one hand, you have Sarah Nelson, who is a small business owner, a former legislative aide to Richard Conlon. Very pro-business, rather conservative. She has raised $415,000, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at for a city council race. Close behind her, however, is Nikita Oliver, who's the progressive candidate in the race. She has raised $391,000. So that, again, is very tight between the two and could change in the last weeks of the campaign. So those are the competitive ones in the city of Seattle. And we'll be talking a lot more about them next week.
All right. Well, the carpenters, local carpenters, had a strike going on that was actually getting a fair amount of coverage as far as strikes go.
National coverage as well.
Yeah, but in part due to just one of the council members being involved to a degree too.
Shama Sawant was very vocal in her support, and actually the union was trying to distance themselves from her because, you know, within labor circles, she's a, to put it mildly, a controversial figure. But the carpenters had been on strike for a couple of weeks, and I think one of the reasons it got so much attention is, of course, Seattle is awash in construction, and that was affecting a lot of major construction projects. Not just the carpenters striking, but other construction workers honoring the picket line and refusing to cross the picket line. On Friday, the union had a vote, and it approved a contract that had been negotiated earlier in the week. And the carpenters got much of what they were asking for. You know, labor activism works. Activism in general works, but labor activism in particular. So that was heartening to see. And they will be going back to work, I presume, on Monday, if not over the weekend.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Once upon a time, they actually used to have, at least some of the papers used to have regular labor writers, which for some reason corporate media doesn't seem to be covering that much anymore. But turns out that in addition to their local strike, that there's been strikes going on across the country, and quite a few of them.
Yeah, for the last month, actually, there's been quite a few of them.
Yeah.
It's a season for strikes. And some of that has to do with negotiating safety from the pandemic, which we'll talk about in a minute. But a lot of it is wages, because we're facing more inflation than we've seen in some time. And so negotiating pay that's commensurate with cost of living increases has been a real issue in a lot of these things. And, of course, the usual side benefits that are often central to a strike, like, you know, paying for healthcare costs, that sort of thing, also figures in some of these strikes. So you had a list of them?
I do. I have pilfered this from a Guardian article written by Michael Senato. And he writes that Kellogg's workers are currently on strike. They were leaned upon to give up their weekends or to work grueling 12-hour shifts during the pandemic.
And that strike has been going on for at least a month.
And not to confuse, when I initially saw that, I had actually confused that with the Nabisco workers' strike that recently won their concession. So, in addition to that, 24,000 nurses and other healthcare workers at Kaiser Permanente in California, represented by the United Nurses Association of California, will be voting on strike authorization. Union took issue with Kaiser's Permanente's 1% wage increase for workers, cuts to wages for new staff, and benefit cuts in the company's most recent offer, which, again, you have to put in perspective with, you know, all the healthcare workers that have been scrambling during the pandemic, and Kaiser making, you know, again, all these companies are making record profits while they're, like, ratcheting down benefits.
And 1% isn't nearly enough to even keep up with inflation, let alone reward healthcare workers for the substantial risk and the enormous amount of hours that they've been putting in over the last year and a half.
So in addition to that, about 700 building engineers at Kaiser Permanente in the San Francisco area are already on strike. An additional 3,400 health workers in Oregon and 7,400 health workers with USW at Kaiser Permanente also announced strike authorization votes.
There's another 2,000 that are on strike in Buffalo.
I was going to get to that. After four months of negotiation with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees announced a strike authorization vote for 60,000 workers across the film and television industry in the U.S. So we might, like, literally be seeing the effects of that on our television.
Yeah, that's getting a lot of attention. The last time they went on strike, that's what gave us the plague of reality TV, because there were no screenwriters and none of the, you know, sitcoms, dramas, et cetera, were in production. So the studios all turned to reality television, which of course is also scripted, but it, doesn't require, union screenwriters to do. You know, a trained monkey could actually probably do it if they typed enough. So, that's what's given us a lot of garbage TV that a lot of people apparently enjoy.
And other large groups of workers that have voted to authorize strikes across the U.S. is 2,000 Frontier Communication workers in California, transit workers in Beaumont, Texas, and Akron, Ohio, 450 public works employees in Minneapolis, Minnesota,
I want to back up. A strike in Texas is highly unusual because it's a right-to-work state. So those strikers can be fired at will if their employer thinks that they can replace them. So the shortage of workers in a lot of industries is probably influencing that, would be my guess.
There's about 1,100 coal miners in Alabama that have been on strike for the past 6 months. September 12th, 10,000 plus John Deere production and warehouse workers in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas voted 9% to go on strike.
Yeah, that Alabama coal miner strike, by the way, has been extremely contentious. There's been a lot of clashes with police at demonstrations and things like that. And it's gotten some national attention because, you know, it's Alabama. That's unusual. But they are on strike. And, you know, coal mining is not a fun job. It's hard work, and it's work that, you know, is hazardous to your health long term. And, I don't blame them for striking.
Both short term and long term, potentially short term and definitely long term. Yeah. So, and as you said previously, nurses in the Buffalo, New York area are
at Mercy Hospital institutions.
And that was all just gathered from, you know, a single article from The Guardian on October 1st. So there's no doubt there are numerous other strikes that are in the pipeline and that we don't know about. So,
yeah, it's definitely not a comprehensive list, but it gives you a sense of just how much labor activism is going on that is not getting media attention. As you say, there were labor sections in newspapers up until the 1980s or so, and they got replaced by business sections for some reason during the 80s. And then, you know, the various online media that have come up in the last 20 years have not really, except for, you know, specialty sites, they have not really jumped into that void either.
Yeah, and then in parallel, newsrooms are just ratcheting down their local coverage of it producing news at all and relying on their corporate overlords to supply them with, you know, nationally produced news that basically is the same message in every city across the U.S.
Yeah, most business sections at this point are a lot of AP articles. You'll notice that in the Seattle Times, for example. Yeah. Where they might have one or two local articles that are locally reported, and the rest of it is all AP or a reprint from the New York Times or Washington Post. And the Seattle Times is one of the larger newspapers in the country. They're a major regional paper. It tells you just how much newsrooms across the country have been cut back and what their priorities are.
Exactly. So, all right. Well, let's move on to this week's COVID-related news.
Yeah, well, there is still a pandemic going on, and a reminder as the weather gets colder and rainier that people are moving indoors, and even if you are fully vaccinated, you should still be wearing a mask indoors to protect yourself and others. And that's not just my opinion. That's a guidance from King County, Seattle King County Health Department, which is still in effect. That has not gone away. Locally and statewide, the number of new cases is dropping. Hospitalizations and deaths have not started dropping yet, but hopefully that they will follow suit. Those are lagging indicators compared to the new case numbers. But, you know, they're still very high compared to what they were, say, in June, when we bottomed out at something like, you know, 40 new cases a day. Now it's quote unquote down to about 600 a day in King County. And, that's still, you know, 15 times the number that we had, in early summer. So there's still a pandemic afoot. You should still be taking precautions. We hit some major milestones, in Washington yesterday. The state hit, 600,000 confirmed cases and 8,000 deaths from the COVID, during the pandemic. And then nationally, we passed 44 million confirmed cases, which is, again, just a staggering number. We are very close to passing, if we didn't do that overnight, 700,000 deaths in the U.S., which is also a huge number. It's coming very close to matching the entire population of Seattle, the city of Seattle. So that gives you a sense of the scale of the loss. And, you know, the news coverage, I mean, there's sort of a COVID update section in a lot of newspapers and websites, but it's really not getting the attention that it got early in the pandemic. I think mostly because people are tired of reading about it. They're certainly tired of taking precautions that would keep people safe. You know, I see a lot of people going around without masks, including in indoor spaces in Seattle. And, King County has reached 80% of its population having at least one vaccine shot. That's a good figure, but it's not herd immunity, not by a long stretch, not with the Delta variant. Delta variant is probably needs to be closer to 90%, and it's unlikely that that's going to happen pretty much anywhere in the country, given the level of resistance on the right wing and within you know, anti-vaccine activists. So, you know, we still need to protect ourselves until those numbers get down a lot more. We're not even close yet. And with the holiday seasons coming up, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, it has the potential to go back up, especially with the weather changing and all the rest of it. the good news is that, at least in Washington State, with the mask mandate that is in place, we haven't really seen a lot of outbreaks. The Seattle School District is reporting about 100 new cases a week, which out of tens of thousands of students, it could be a lot worse. And in fact, in parts of the country that don't have mask mandates in schools, it is a lot worse. We saw, for instance, in Florida yesterday that the Florida Board of Education voted to withdraw funding from school districts that don't enforce Governor Ron DeSantis' edict that bans mask mandates in K-12 schools in Florida. But the Biden administration has said they would pitch in and cover the funding for those districts that, resist mask mandate bans. So we'll see whether that happens. And, of course, there is still a lawsuit pending at the Florida Supreme Court over that mask mandate ban. DeSantis has stacked the Florida Supreme Court with his appointees, so they are likely to side with him. But that ruling has not yet come down, so we're looking at that too. And Florida is not the only state that's in deep trouble with schools and masks. Tennessee is particularly bad. Texas, of course, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, pretty much the whole South is in that same boat because they have either Republican governors or Republican legislators that have made taking basic public health measures in the schools nearly impossible. And you would hope there's going to be some blowback to that come the next election, because, people should object to, endangering the health of their kids. If there's one thing that is sacrosanct in U.S. politics, it's that we do everything for the kids. Well, they're doing everything they can to kill the kids. So we'll see if the inverse is true, if voters actually care about the kids, or that's just a political trope that we hear all over and over. We'll see. But that's the status of the pandemic. It is still raging in a lot of parts of the globe. It is subsiding in much of Europe right now, because Europe is more vaccinated even than North America. The high 80% of people who've had at least one vaccine shot across all of Europe, that's including Eastern Europe with a lot of countries that didn't have a lot of early access to vaccines. So, on the other hand, countries in Asia and particularly Africa and South America are really struggling with vaccine outbreaks. Brazil, which of course has been one of the worst countries in the world, is subsiding a little bit in its outbreak, but virtually every other country in South America is, and much of the Caribbean as well, particularly the Dominican Republic, is really struggling with outbreaks. So if you're planning on a vacation in the Caribbean, I would double check and see whether your destination is one of those countries that has an outbreak that's raging out of control. A lot of those countries, again, have not had good access to vaccines, and that's leading to the problem. The one exception in the Caribbean to that is Cuba, which says it has manufactured its own vaccine and hopes to have its entire population vaccinated by the end of the year. So, and of course they can do that, so it's an authoritarian country. So we'll see how that pans out and whether their numbers go down. Cuba has been very hard hit over the last couple of months, but that again has started to subside as more of its population gets vaccinated.
Yeah, I have to say that 2 weeks ago when I saw the kids walking to school in mass for the first time in, in forever, it seems like that was like so uplifting to see things in a way returning to normal, And at the same time, I'm like feeling really good about that. And then I'm also like feeling like, oh no, it's going to ramp back up, at least with the the local schools.
Yeah. Well, they are getting some cases and isolated outbreaks in different places. But by and large, the masks have been working because masks work and the vaccines work. So if you haven't gotten vaccinated, again, go do it now. And if you're not wearing a mask to public places, you should be, even if you're vaccinated. Protect yourself, protect other people.
All right. Well, let's move on. Texas seems to be going back and forth regarding abortions and judges. And I mean, it's like every couple days we get a different report.
Yeah, on Wednesday, a federal appeals judge overturned Texas' abortion ban. That's functionally what it is. Was signed into law, I guess, about a month ago by Governor Abbott. And even though it's clearly unconstitutional, if you believe Roe versus Wade is a binding precedent. It went from that court to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the most conservative of the 11 circuit judge offices, I guess, in the United States. It's very heavily stacked with conservative Republican-leaning judges. And yesterday, they set aside that appeals court ruling. So Texas's abortion ban is back into effect. For 2 days, you could get an abortion in Texas if you could find a provider who's still in business. And, it's now off again. And from there, it will probably go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that of course, is very highly problematic because the Supreme Court already had an opportunity to issue a stay, which would functionally have stopped the enforcement of that law, at least until it wound its way through the courts, and did not do so, even though it clearly violates Roe v. Wade, because Roe v. Wade, it says abortion is legal and a constitutional right at less than 20 weeks from inception. And the Texas law specifies 6 weeks, which is often earlier than many women know they're actually pregnant. So the Texas law was clearly meant to violate that. It got around the 20-week minimum, and the Supreme Court had its out because the Supreme Court said, well, we don't have jurisdiction because it's actually enforced not by the state but by individuals who can sue abortion recipients and get a $10,000 bounty, essentially, if they find out that some woman has had an abortion in Texas or anywhere else, as long as she's a resident of Texas. And the Department of Justice has sued Texas, claiming that particular provision, laws can't be enforced by private individuals. So they're suing on that basis, and that has not yet wound its way through the courts. It's a previous lawsuit that's making its way now to the Supreme Court. We'll see how that turns out. But the Supreme Court likely won't rule on that until next summer. So at least until then, you really can't get an abortion in Texas unless you catch it very, very early. And there are several providers in different parts of the state that are trying to stay in business and, offer their services to those women who qualify. But, Texas is a big, big state. You might have to go, 100, 200 miles to find one of those clinics. And Texas has previously enacted restrictions that make it a multi-day procedure. You have to have a 24-hour waiting period. You have to have a completely unnecessary invasive procedure by a doctor twice rather than once, just to make sure that the fetus is okay. And the mother's health, of course, isn't really material. But, you have to get read this you know, ridiculous anti-abortion screed by a healthcare provider. Texas has already made it very, very difficult to get an abortion, even before this law. That kind of hurdle of traveling that kind of distance and having, you know, motel rooms and all the rest of it for several days, taking time off work if you can, et cetera, when the clock is already ticking and, you know, if it passes 6 weeks, that's it. You can't get an abortion. It's illegal. So, that makes it really prohibitive for a lot of women, especially poorer women, women of color, et cetera. And of course, that was exactly the point, right? That's who it targets. People who are more wealthier can fly out of state and, you know, have their medical procedure done quietly by somebody in a nearby, state that allows abortions, or not nearby, you know, flying to Chicago or wherever. But if you're poor, you don't have those kind of options. So mm-hmm. that is very much the point of that law, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. Well, last week, you spoke a bit about what was going on with the House Select Committee regarding January 6th. Any further developments this week?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. The first four people who were targeted, they're aides of Donald Trump, who were targeted by the House's subpoenas before, you know, there were 11 additional subpoenas last week. Those initial four, which include Steve Bannon, who, of course, is very high profile, and then Mark Meadows is the former chief of staff, the deadline for their complying with their subpoenas came and went on Friday. None of the four actually have complied so far. However, two of them, including Meadows, according to the committee, have said that they are engaging with the committee and, you know, negotiating and trying to get their act together, basically. So that apparently is in process. There's one more aide who can't be found, oddly enough, Dan Scavino. He cannot be located to be served with the subpoena. So the clock isn't ticking on that one yet. And then the fourth is Bannon, who has said he's going to defy the subpoena and do so under the guise of executive privilege. Now, he hasn't worked at the White House since 2017, and Trump is no longer president, although people on the right don't necessarily agree with that. So it's not clear what kind of leg he would have to stand on legally. But it does slow the clock while, you know, the House would have to pursue charges, all the rest of that. Now, the House committee does have the power to simply throw these people's butts in jail. That hasn't been done since, like, the 19th century or something ridiculous. But if ever there were a time, you know, it hasn't been done primarily because, you know, most people honor subpoenas from Congress. That wasn't really until Trump came along and his administration came along that Republicans figured out that they could openly defy it and Democrats wouldn't do anything about it. So the question is, in this case, whether Democrats will do something about it. The Select Committee does seem pretty serious about trying to get testimony from these people, or at least depositions. So, and certainly the documentation as well. And they say they're making good progress in their investigation. So I expect that there will be criminal complaint referrals coming out of this eventually. But I don't know whether it's an open question whether they will pursue remedies against the people who are defying subpoenas, particularly Bannon, who is already in legal trouble for running a scam charity, appealing to Trump supporters. In the last couple of years of Trump's presidency, he's facing charges for that as well. So he's in all kinds of legal trouble right now, as he should be, because he's trying to foment a organized coup of the U.S. government. That's what he's doing, and that's what the January 6th Commission is or committee is investigating. So all indications are that they're taking their investigation pretty seriously. Since the Democrats have a long history of not playing hardball, shall we say, certainly compared to the Republicans who make an art of it. You know, we'll see whether they pursue any kind of legal remedies against Bannon or not. I hope they do, because they really need to set that precedent also for other Democratic-led investigations.
It would be nice. You know, just
wouldn't it be nice? Oh, never mind.
Yeah, just for a change of pace.
Although, if ever I was going to break into song, it's best to do it in a week when Murray is not here.
All right. Well, you'll have to
One of us can carry a tune, and it's not Maria. Just saying. She has many wonderful gifts, but that's not one of them.
Easy to say when she's not here to defend herself.
Yes, or attack me. Yes. Hopefully, she doesn't listen to the podcast. She's very busy at work, so I'm banking and protecting my. Betting my physical health on the idea that she won't. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
All right.
I like to live dangerously.
Apparently. So, moving on. This week's, well, it goes back to last week as well. Incidents involving police officers.
This week's edition of Cops Behaving Badly. There's usually at least one or two every week. Police in Dayton, Ohio, forcibly pulled a paraplegic man out of his vehicle and threw him to the ground. That video has gone viral. Not surprisingly, the paraplegic man is African American. And the officers were white. That seems to be a running theme with these kind of incidents. The other one that has gotten, and he was very clear with them that he was paraplegic and could not move as they instructed him to do because he was paralyzed. But they didn't care. So, there was that. And then, another incident which happened earlier this year, but has just come to light in the last week, is an incident in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is a city outside Nashville, where 10 different elementary school students, all of them African American, some as young as 8 years old, were arrested and put in jail by local police. Their crime was, and they were actually charged, their crime was, quote, criminal responsibility for conduct of another. In this case, they watched a fight between 2 10-year-old boys. A lot of the onlookers were girls. And so the boys weren't charged. These were all African Americans, but the girls were. And there were, I think, a couple boys mixed into that crowd as well. They were charged with that crime. The problem is that under Tennessee law, that's not a crime. They were charged with something that doesn't exist. So you've got kids as young as 8 years old, put in handcuffs, taken out of school, thrown in jail, and charged with a crime that doesn't exist. Now, the problem with this is that Rutherford County, which is where Murfreesboro is located, has a system where, essentially, the juvenile justice system is run by one person who's been there for 20 years and, thinks it's, this is a direct quote, it's God's mission that she be a hard ass on these kids, so that they'll learn a proper lesson and learn respect for the law, et cetera, et cetera. The kids were charged well after and taken out of school well after the fact, because a video of the fight went viral, and it took Murfreesboro investigators some time to identify who all the kids were. But they managed to do it, and so all the kids were arrested and charged with a crime that doesn't exist. How this can happen, just because of the kids' age, number one, and then to be charged with a crime that doesn't exist, number two, that requires cooperation of prosecutors too. It's just mind blowing. And you know, it's one of those only in America kind of things. You just can't wrap your brain around. It's completely
nuts.
Common sense would dictate that you approach that very differently. You know, and if you want to hold kids culpable for watching a fight that they probably didn't intervene in because the boys are larger and stronger, and you don't want to get beat up in turn because that's how schoolyard – and this wasn't a schoolyard fight. This was off of school grounds. It was prosecuted strictly because the video surfaced and went viral locally. You know, words fail. It's just mind-blowingly authoritarian. It's the only word I can come up with for it. You have to have that kind of a mindset to think that kids that young should be held culpable under criminal law for, number one, a crime that didn't exist, but number two, a really common situation for kids. I mean, you know, fights happen, and kids watch them because it's, you know, entertaining and exciting. You know, I certainly watched fights when I was a kid, and I was never worried about getting arrested for it. It would never even have occurred to me. I don't think it would occur to most people, but it did occur to the people in charge in Rutherford County, Tennessee, none of whom, by the way, have been disciplined for this outrageous abuse of power. They all still have their jobs. You know, they've gotten some negative public attention, but that's about it. Yeah. La-di-da. Move on to the next victims. I mean, suspects. Whatever. And also there's the racial component in that the kids were all African American. Exactly. And the school is 2/3 black and Latina. So, you know, go figure.
Okay. You know, last week we didn't have time to cover it, but, there had been a report. I know you saw it, the article about it anyway. There'd been a report in the Lancet that calculated that 17,000, there were 17,000 additional people killed by police over the last 40 years that have been not officially reported.
Yes, or they were misreported. They were, you know, the cause of death was listed as, you know, asphyxiation when it was asphyxiation caused by an officer with his hands around the neck or something like that. A staggering number of police killings in the United States, have been buried. And of course, this goes back to the complete lack of any central federal, agency that tallies law enforcement caused deaths in the United States. There is no, of course, a number of media outlets have now started tallying them after the George Floyd murder. But up until then, you know, there were very few. There were a few activist groups, the Marshall Project in particular comes to mind, that were trying to tally law enforcement killings, and almost nobody saw those figures. It was very hard to find. You had to know where to look on the internet. Now, you know, major media outlets like, you know, networks and say the New York Times, etc., have begun tallying them, but even that's likely an incomplete list. And again, the Marshall Project shows how it can be so incomplete when the cause of death locally is listed as something else. It's very hard for national media outlets to pick up on that. So it's probably still an undercount when you see those figures. There have been some very high profile killings over the last year and a half since George Floyd died. But most of them are only local stories, if that. It's much more common. And again, I could come up with these stories pretty much every week for this show. And it only takes a little bit of searching.
Yeah. But it amazed me just the coverage, the lack of coverage on that. It was, you know, covered a little bit for a very short period of time, but it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, let's talk about the contract of our star quarterback. You know, that'll get far more attention in our TV newscast.
Yeah.
You know, any number of things do. Because law enforcement killings are considered routine. They're not that big a deal, except for the, you know, family and community of the person who's been killed. And, you know, more recently, a generation of activists now has learned to watch for those incidents. And the really egregious ones, the ones that are captured on video, where there's clearly no justification for the killing, those can still spawn protests. But that's about it.
Yeah, well,
that is about it.
As we've noted before, the big kicker here is that videotape or video of these incidents circulates, and that seems to be what is the real catalyst towards bringing this to people's attention.
Yeah, and you know, summer 2020's protests have borne fruit in that we've seen a lot of local jurisdictions enact changes and reforms in how law enforcement killings can be prosecuted. And we've seen more and more of those cases being criminally prosecuted, where the police are at least forced to stand trial. Getting a conviction can be another matter. But in the case of people like Derek Chauvin, he's sort of the exception that proves the rule, in that that was an incredibly egregious killing of George Floyd. And, you know, the outcome of that trial was really in doubt until the verdict was read. Because people didn't know whether it only takes one person on a jury who's sympathetic to police to prevent the conviction. So, you know, we still have a long way to go in this country. And we still need a fundamental reexamination of how we enforce public safety in this country. Because the model we use of police enforcement and police agencies dates to the 19th century. And a lot of it really isn't appropriate for the 21st century. We're starting to see some of those changes in Seattle. Certainly sending out mental health professionals to mental health calls rather than officers with guns is a big, big step. And we've seen that work well in a lot of jurisdictions already, particularly Denver and New York City. But a lot of places where it hasn't happened yet and needs to.
Yeah. I would add that I don't think our reasoning and protocols were correct in the 19th century either. But
well, no, of course not.
Events. Any events?
Oh, yeah. I got Social Justice Film Festival started this week, and it's going on through the 17th. It's being held online, so it's accessible to anybody. And it's being hosted by the Wallingford Meaningful Movies. So you can search for them on Google. That's easier than reading the URL. But a lot of really, really good movies coming up this week. So I would encourage people to check that out.
All right. Well, I await receiving my ballot this week so that I may participate in what's left of, luckily, at least a local democracy.
Yeah, and this is something I always tell people about democracy and electoral politics. For both of them, activism, you can affect change and you can make it different most easily at a local level. The national issues or international issues usually get all the headlines, but that's very difficult to influence. Local stuff, you can have a voice and you can influence it. And your vote does matter, so get out and vote. When you get your ballot, and if you're not sure who to vote for, tune in next week, and we will go over all the different offices and all the different ballot measures that are on the ballot this year, so you can make a more informed decision.